This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 219. Today we speak with David Skeel and James Sweet about the state and religious liberty. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 219, and we are very delighted to be here today in studio. We have all the guests in studio, and we are going to be talking about something maybe unexpected. We're going to be speaking with some lawyers and going to be speaking about some recent Supreme Court decisions that have a direct bearing upon our daily lives as Christians and upon the relationship of the government to the church, particularly in the United States. Let me introduce to you today our panel. First, we have James Sweet, who is counsel and director of special programs at Westminster Theological Seminary here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program, Jim. It's good to have you back.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be here.
Of course, Jim helped us out tremendously in allowing us to become a 501c3 organization. He helped us with our filing and all of our information so that we are official and on the books now as a nonprofit organization. So thanks again, Jim, for having us, and thanks for all your help with us and everything that you're doing here at Westminster Theological Seminary as well. I should mention that Jim is also former chairman of Drinker, Biddle, and Reith, a very well-known legal firm. We're also very pleased to welcome back to the program our guest, Dr. David Skeel, who is professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also the co-author of the blog Less Than the Least and had a recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. Welcome back, David. It's great to have you on again.
It's great to be back.
David is an elder, correct, at 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia, and he's appeared on the program before discussing other related issues, and so we're delighted to have qualified individuals here, legal experts, but also a professor of law, to discuss some things that are very important for the life of the church. But before we get started, I would like to mention, of course, in line with us being a 501c3 organization, that we are listener-supported, and we do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners and viewers to help us to continue to produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge. So if you're able to help, please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate, and you can pledge your support today online. You can even send us a check or cash or whatever you want to mail us would be fantastic, and the information for that is on the web as well, our P.O. box. I do want to thank everybody for supporting what we do here on Reform Forum and this program, Christ the Center. Well, gentlemen, I'm really delighted to speak about this, and we sometimes hear about these decisions that relate to religion and then the relationship of the church and state. We hear them on regular media, but we don't always hear them in application to theology, or more an application directly to the concerns of our audience and Reformed churches in particular. So we have here a recent decision, a recent case, an appeal that went all the way up to the Supreme Court dealing with the Hosanna-Tabor Evangelical Lutheran Church and School in Redford, Michigan. And it relates to an alleged violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. David, could you provide a little background for us and telling us what the issue was in this case and then why it's applicable to Christians?
Sure. The issue in the case involved a school teacher in this Lutheran school, which and the teacher had an illness. I think, was it narcolepsy?
Narcolepsy, yeah.
She had narcolepsy, and she had to take time off, and eventually reached an impasse with the school where the school hesitated to bring her back on board. She threatened to sue, and the school laid her off. And mm-hmm. so she argued that in laying her off, the school was violating the Americans with Disabilities Act. Mm-hmm. And the school responded by saying that there is effectively a religious exception to that. So in terms of its applicability, certainly applies potentially to any Christian school, any Christian ministry, and mm-hmm. I think we'll get into exactly what the contours of the decision mm-hmm. are. The decision ends up drawing a distinction between ministers and people who have ministerial functions, really core religious functions mm-hmm. on the one hand, and on the other hand, folks who do not.
Like accountants or IT people.
Or law professors.
I don't think, last I checked, UPenn is not a religious organization.
No, it is not, and has long prided itself on that fact.
Well, a little more background. Reading here are facts of the case, which was, what was the name of that site? Oyez or Oye? How do you
Oye.
Pronounce it? Yeah,
Oye.
Oye,
right, yeah.
Reading from a link there, I'll try to put a link to this in the show notes. This woman's name, Cheryl Perrick, filed a lawsuit against the Hosanna Tabor Evangelical Lutheran Church and School in Redford, Michigan, for allegedly violating the Americans with Disabilities Act when they fired her after she became sick in 2004. After several months on disability, Perrick was diagnosed and treated for narcolepsy and was able to return to work without restrictions. But she said the school at that point urged her to resign, and when she refused, fired her. Of course, there's going to be a lot more detail to the case.
Yeah, they're just they missed a couple of fairly important points there, I think.
Right. But the suggestion is obviously they're – the illusion here is that she was able to work, and they laid her off or they fired her for various reasons. So the main question in this case is, does the ministerial exception, which prohibits most employment-related lawsuits against religious organizations by employees who do perform religious functions, does that exception apply to a teacher at a religious elementary school who teaches the full secular curriculum but also teaches daily religion classes, is a commissioned minister, and regularly leads students in prayer and worship? So we have some interesting dynamics going on with this. Can you just review a little bit of the appeal process and the general practice of the Supreme Court in accepting an appeal of this nature? Where did this case start, and how fast did it rise to the top, and why did the Supreme Court eventually decide to accept the appeal?
Some of those questions I can only speculate, and I think Jim can only speculate as well. But it starts out in a federal trial court, presumably in Michigan. I don't remember exactly where the case began. It gets appealed to a federal appellate court, which there would be the Sixth Circuit. And then it gets appealed to the Supreme Court. The appeal from the trial level to the appellate court is available in any case. If you have a federal trial court case and you lose, you have a right to appeal to the appellate court.
Basic legal right.
It's a basic legal right. You do not have a right to have the Supreme Court hear your case. So the discretion came in the Supreme Court's decision to hear the case. And your question, in a sense, is why did they take this case? I don't know for sure, but the Supreme Court had never explicitly recognized this ministerial exception that you've been talking about. And this is a very, very big issue. The question of the interaction between secular federal laws and religious institutions is hugely important. It's growing more important. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we had a really important issue, and one on which the Supreme Court had not spoken authoritatively, it had not even said that there is a ministerial exception. So it was possible the Supreme Court would have said
doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist, and any federal law applies to everybody, whether you're in a religious organization or not. So from that kind of a perspective, it was a hugely important case.
So there's really no precedent before, which made it more interesting for the Supreme Court to
No, there were a number of lower court cases that had said there is a ministerial exception. So
I see.
There was lots of precedent in the lower courts, but there was not a Supreme Court precedent.
And typically, the Supreme Court will take cases when there's two circuits don't agree on an important point, for example. But I think in this case, as David said, I think all of the circuit courts that had addressed the issue had come to the conclusion that there was, in fact, a ministerial exception. Let me add a couple of other things
here.
Yeah,
please.
She was commissioned or ordained or called, which is very important in the decision. even though she was doing essentially the same thing a so-called lay teacher was doing, the fact that she was trained and commissioned and called mm-hmm. played a significant role in how the case spun out, because the solicitor representing the EEOC made the argument all along, well, we're not trying to tell the school and the church who their ministers are. We're just trying to make sure that the anti-discrimination laws of the United States are applicable to everyone, whether or not they're a religious organization or not. So this notion that you're trying to choose our ministers is simply a red herring, according to the government. There's a second issue that I thought was significant, and that was there was a tribunal available to her to appeal her dismissal, and that would have been the Synod.
Church Court. Missouri Synod.
Yeah, the Missouri Synod. And right. I'm not sure that that was called out as a significant issue, but the Supreme Court clearly had in the back of its mind this woman had a remedy, another mm-hmm. remedy, which she chose not to avail herself of. Mm-hmm. Instead, what happens in these cases is you file an intent to sue with the EEOC, and the EEOC takes your case. This is basically EEOC in which she then appeared. She intervened in this case, but it was basically a case brought by the EEOC.
And that is?
The Equal Employment Opportunity mm-hmm. Commission. So mm-hmm. which she then intervened in and I think carried the water on it. I think the ACLU carried the water on this too. Mm-hmm. And just from a Christian standpoint and something that I think is really encouraging, we've got a couple of really active and good advocacy organizations out there, the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, for example, which was active in this case, and the Alliance Defense Fund, both of which have taken it on themselves sort of to be the anti-ACLU, if you will, mm-hmm. when there's an issue of significant religious liberty out there, what you will find is often the school is overwhelmed because they've got a local lawyer, and the local lawyer is not sophisticated on these issues, mm-hmm. And so to protect the significant issue, you will get folks like the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty and the other one that I mentioned, the Alliance Defense Fund, intervening because this is what they do, and they're very good at it. Mm-hmm. They're as good as the ACLU is on the other side, which I think is important in balancing the tables on these very difficult cases, because these are difficult cases. They're very difficult. I mean, if you read the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law establishing religion or the free exercise thereof. That's a pretty thin network to base a whole series of jurisprudence on. So these are very difficult cases, Cameron. Yeah. I think it's
absolutely
fair to say.
I should mention as well, just to provide a Presbyterian context for these things, is a related issue. Often people can be called, ministers of the gospel can be called by their Presbyterian installed to things that are not necessarily, you know, a pastoral context in a church.
Right.
So many of the seminary professors, for instance, here, we're on the campus of Westminster Theological Seminary. Many, not all, but many of the professors are ordained ministers, are called by the Presbyterian installed to teach
right.
at the seminary, and the same can be said of a Christian school, that some men, ministers of the gospel, would prefer to have that accountability, would also prefer to serve in the regional church, so they go through the process and become ordained, and then they are installed to their work. So that's really where some of the dynamics or the intricacies of this case come in. The fact that this woman was a minister, a Lutheran minister, and was given to this work at a Christian school, but yet had this opportunity for the tribunal in the Missouri Synod, and also was doing religious work at the same time of doing secular curriculum teaching.
I think one of the real issues here is the entanglement issue, and it came out in the cross-examination, if you will, or the questioning of the solicitor who was representing the EEOC, and that is just a hypo. Mm-hmm. Well, do you take the position, for example, that the Catholic Church now could be required to ordain women as priests?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, we don't take that position. Well,
why not?
Well, why not?
Where's the consistency?
Well, because that's a really important issue. Or, I mean, I was not satisfied by the response, and frankly, there isn't a very principled response, I don't think. And that's, I think that's where Alito and others came down and said, look, this is just, we're going to get entangled in religion here. If we start making these decisions and applying anti-discrimination laws equally to a labor union or to a religious organization, Scalia said at one point to the Solicitor General, that is extraordinary what you're arguing. He was stunned.
Yeah. And this is a unanimous decision. Yeah. It was 9-0 in favor of the school.
9-0. And Elena Kagan actually may have been stronger than the Chief Justice was in some in some respects. But in any event, it was a 9-0 decision.
Now, let me ask you, as we continue our discussion here, can it be addressed whether this was a religious issue or not? Maybe I'm just thinking from a layperson's perspective, an untrained person. Could the court have asked whether this decision was religious related or not? Because obviously the exception would apply to religious issues. We wouldn't want to say that the Catholic Church is required to ordain women because those are religious beliefs. Maybe they fired this woman because she had a health issue that didn't interfere with any of her teaching capacities, but somehow they just wanted to get rid of her for other reasons. Maybe they didn't want to pay the insurance or something like that. Could it have been the court's prerogative? Was it even possible to ask that question, or is that just not even an issue?
I think that's the question. One of the key questions that's lurking underneath the analysis, and that's what Jim was getting at, I think, with his entanglement point. And I think that question is still there. And another way to ask the question would be, if you have a school like this in another case, and it's clearly pretextual what they're doing, that it really has nothing to do with their synod, it has nothing to do with their religious beliefs, they just want to get rid of this teacher, would the Supreme Court say the same thing? Or, for instance, if a school were to fire someone on what looked to be racial grounds, but said really there were religious reasons for doing what we do, would the court ever second guess what a school or a church is doing? I think the answer is yes. That there could be a case where they would second guess what the school or church is doing, but I think they're making really clear they don't want to go down that road. And so if there's a plausible religious explanation and it involves a minister, the fact that it involves a minister is crucially important. And the question of just who is a minister is going to be crucially important. But if it is a minister, I think the court is going to try not to go there.
I agree. In the pretextual issue came up several times in the oral argument. But I think that's a sort of an issue for another day, because you get sham ordinations all the time.
You can get ordained online. Universal Life Church.
Universal Life Church, Church Bedside Baptist, or something like that. You know, so I think those are issues that are the government may come back on someday. Well, this is clearly pretextual. It's prima facie pretextual, but didn't carry the day here.
No.
That's for sure.
And they made very clear, I think, they don't want to be looking at those kinds of issues, that it would have to be outrageously pretextual, I think, before the court's going to dive in.
And that's not really something that the Supreme Court is interested in or concerned with getting into, are they?
Not if they can help it. And that is the one consistent theme in these cases going back a century is, if it looks like the court is going to be addressing court church dogma, as they often refer to it, they went out. They don't want to go down that road.
That makes sense. But a fascinating discussion here. Let's come back to the issue of the church court and the appeal process. What if a church, for religious reasons, let's say they're a highly hierarchical or Episcopalian type model, which the Catholic Church is Episcopalian-type model in terms of a bishop being in charge. What if, for religious reasons, there is no appeal process? Yeah. The pope or the head bishop says that's the case, it's an infallible declaration or whatever, no appeal process, that's it. That's a religious belief.
Well, as I said, that issue was lurking back there. The Supreme Court clearly had in its mind that this woman did not, as we say in the trade, exhaust her remedies. But I don't think – I'm not sure it was a key point in coming to the decision. In other words, if there hadn't been an opportunity to exhaust her remedies, I don't know that the court would have decided the case any differently because, as a matter of principle, they found she was a minister, and they found that there is a ministerial exception. So, David, I don't know if you agree with that, but I don't know what they would have done, frankly, if there had been no higher court, if you will, the Synod in this case. Do you have a different opinion?
I don't have a strong opinion one way or another. I didn't get the sense that that was driving them that much. I may have been mistaken, but I guess I would read the opinion as saying even if she does not have a higher internal court, church court to go to,
I agree.
She still loses. That she is a minister. She subjected herself by taking this job to the rules and the oversight of the school, and because she is performing ministerial religious functions, she's subject to them. So I
agree.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
My only point is it was lurking back there because I mentioned it sometime, and I think it gave him a little internal comfort is all I'm saying. And sometimes you never know why judges decide things the way they do. Mm-hmm. I tried cases for years, and I never knew why I won or lost, frankly. So.
Is that what you told your clients?
Yeah.
I don't know if we're going to lose or win. But.
Sometimes you just don't know.
Yeah.
You just don't know why, what appeals, what arguments appeal to a court and what don't. But I think in this case it's clearly the issues that David outlined that caused it. And this was mm-hmm. this was a clearly a subordinate matter that didn't mm-hmm. affect the decision.
Now, we've brought up the point about the Solicitor General. What is the White House's involvement here, and how did things go about this, and how much does the executive branch have to do with maybe trying to set the stage for some of these arguments?
Well, that's other than, a fascinating question, yeah. But I'm going to defer to we both other have than, thoughts on this, I'm sure.
We probably do. I mean, the Solicitor General is often referred to as the president's lawyer, mm-hmm. and so the president has a great deal of control. In fact, I believe the president can instruct the Solicitor General which position to take on an issue. And from time to time, the president will overrule what the Solicitor General was planning to do. So the Solicitor General is really the executive branch. It's really representing the views of the administration.
Right. Appointed by the administration and serves at the administration's pleasure and articulates, I believe, the positions of the administration, not just the president, but broadly the administration.
Yeah.
So I think you can say that the fact that the solicitor, assistant solicitor in this case, who I thought made an excellent argument, was clearly very good, was not mistakenly mm-hmm. saying things, the fact that she articulated a position that essentially, for purposes of the anti-discrimination laws, such as came into play here, labor unions, organizations, and religious organizations are treated the same. That's a position that's pretty aggressive.
Right.
It's pretty aggressive. That's not pretty aggressive. That's very aggressive. And it was so aggressive that, as I said, the Justice Scalia, you have to hear it, but he essentially said, that is extraordinary.
Yeah, the audio is available online. I'll put a link to that as well, and you can actually go listen to
he was
the
stunned.
Audio. It's fascinating.
Or at least he acted like he was stunned. And so the fact that this was a very aggressive position being asserted by the Solicitor General, I don't think was an accident. I think it reflects generally the view of the administration on these issues. And I think as you look at some of these other data points that hopefully we'll get into now or later, mm-hmm. you'll see that that there is an increasing, how would we say it, David, increasing interest by government regulators in to breach this religious barrier that the First Amendment, this free exercise clause that the First Amendment is put up. Now, that's my view. I mean, that's opinion. That's maybe not what a law professor would say. But
so you're suggesting law professors don't simply give opinions?
No. Law professors are much more by the books.
I'm flattered that you would think so, but let me give my opinion.
All right.
Which is, I do think that's a lot of what was driving, at least the way the case was written, what the Supreme Court wrote the opinion. Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote the opinion, went out of his way to reject the argument, the government's argument, that any protection churches have is the same protection as any other association, mm-hmm. any other group. And the Supreme Court firmly pretty aggressively said that simply is not true. There's no basis for that in the Constitution. There's no basis mm-hmm. for that in our cases. So that was one of the big takeaways of the decision, is religion is special under our Constitution.
And the fascinating thing is that Elena Kagan was the solicitor earlier in the administration, and they apparently totally misread this, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, how would you explain that? How could you misread it so badly that even the former solicitor, who presumably shared the views of the administration, came down as strongly as she did against the government?
She was appointed by the administration.
Yeah. The only thing I can think of is there's a case from about 20 years ago. I think it's a 1989 case called Smith, which had held – it was a case that involved peyote, the drug that some
Native American
yeah. religions use. And the Supreme Court said, in an opinion by Justice Scalia
yeah.
that religions are subject to the same laws everybody else is subject to, so that these Native Americans could be prosecuted for smoking peyote.
Even though it was part of their religious
right. And so I think what the Solicitor General was probably thinking is this is simply an extension of the Smith case, suggesting that there's nothing special about religions, at least if we're talking about a law that's not singling the religion out, that applies to everybody. And so another important takeaway from this opinion, I think, is that it really raises questions about that earlier decision. It does suggest mm-hmm. that religion is special, and it does suggest that at least in the Supreme Court, there is an interest in carving out a space so that religion and religious organizations can operate without interference from secular law or from the government.
Wow. That's that's fascinating.
You know, we could talk about the significance of Hosanna Tabor for a long time.
Yeah.
A lot has been written about it, but there's a couple of broader data points out there, too,
yeah.
that came out at the same time. Let me just touch on them.
Please, go ahead.
And then maybe at a later date or whatever, we can talk about it. But about the same time, there was a Sixth Circuit case called Julia Moore versus Eastern Michigan University, which I think is a significant case, too. It involved a woman named Julia Moore who was in beyond bachelor. I guess she was getting her master's in counseling
uh-huh.
at Eastern Michigan. And as part of her practicum, she was under the care of her mentors doing counseling work. And she learned in advance that somebody that had been assigned to her was homosexual. And she read from this that she would be looked to affirm that lifestyle.
Mm.
And so she asked for a referral of this person away because while she said she would be happy to counsel a homosexual, she could not affirm the lifestyle given mm-hmm. her Christian positions. Well, what happened was they essentially said, if you can't do that because the American Counseling Association, the organizing body here, has a no referral policy apparently, or so they said. So they took her out of the program. They
yeah.
booted her out of the program. She sued, and back to this federal court issue, the Eastern Michigan University was awarded what we call summary judgment, essentially on the law. There was no facts at issue, and the court found Eastern Michigan was yeah. allowed to do this as a matter of law. And this gets into another real tough issue of pedagogy in the academy that I don't think we need to go to. But essentially, the Sixth Circuit reversed and found that a jury could find her being taken out of the program entirely pretextual because, one, there was no ban by the ACA on referrals, and Eastern Michigan had allowed referrals before. So it went back for a jury. It's going to go back for a trial so that she can show that her religious – this is a religious liberty clause again.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Dave, I don't know if you read that case too, but it was interesting that it came down. A second religious liberty case came down at about the same time. They're different cases.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it is a religious liberty clause.
Yeah. Well, just to throw things open when we need to be finishing. I know. There's another set of issues that's come out at the same time as well, which is a little bit different but related, and that is shortly after the Hosanna-Tabor decision came down, the Obama administration issued a ruling that said under the health care law that was passed a couple of years ago, there is an exception for churches with respect to the healthcare law's requirement that they provide contraception and abortion pills and things like that, but it is a very limited exception, and that the exception would only apply to churches and pervasively religious organizations. It would not apply to things like many Catholic schools, or it would apply to, I guess it would apply to most Catholic schools.
It might, yeah, but not charities and hospitals.
Right, not charities and not hospitals, which seemed to be a ruling from within the administration that was at odds at least with the spirit of Hosanna-Tabor. The ruling seemed to suggest that any religious carve-out was going to be as limited as possible, and in the weeks since then, the issue has really blown up.
Now, what happened with President Obama after he went back to try to formulate some sort of compromise? Mm-hmm. What was the outcome of that?
So the compromise was that many people put compromise in quotes, was that insurance companies would be required to provide contraception and abortion pills and things like that. The churches and schools would not themselves be required to provide this coverage.
It's still accessible to their employees if their employees
want it. It would be accessible to their employees, and it created a big problem, has created a big problem with a number of organizations, particularly those that self-insure. So that if the Catholic charity, instead of having an insurance company provide its health insurance, provides bears the costs of the health insurance itself, this ruling is essentially saying that the charity has to provide contraception coverage for its employees.
And even those that aren't self-insured, they're still paying the premium. So I mean, it's a bit of a sham. And the interesting thing, again, for another day, David, that I see in all of this is the language of accommodation. We're accommodating the church. I find that to be kind of offensive language. And the reason I find it to be offensive is it's in the Constitution that you have free exercise rights. So the government shouldn't be accommodating anything. I just find the term we're going to accommodate these people. Well, no, this is a matter of extraordinary personal conscience with the Catholic Church. And I mean, initially they were going to give them a year to get used to it. And I think Timothy Dolan had the classic line. He said, "Well, they're giving us a year to figure out a way to violate our consciences." I thought that was a great line. I thought, this has been our position forever. We're not going to change our position in a year.
Oh, yeah.
And the other classic line was somebody said, even Jesus Christ would have had to couldn't have met the standards here. So
anyway,
this whole issue of the regulations is going to play out, I think. The issue that I mentioned before, that the government has taken the position, for example, that historically you could get a reduction of your student loan down to zero.
Yeah.
Ultimately, if you work for a 501c3.
Yeah.
Just in February. I mean, it's striking. Let me just read you how this changed, because I think this is, again, I'm finding myself being a conspiracy theorist here.
I'm more and more each day becoming suspicious. The thing that frightens me so much too is the growing power of the executive branch.
Yeah,
it's getting
out
of control.
Here's the old rule. Qualifying employment is any employment with a federal, state, or local government agency or organization or a nonprofit organization that has been designated tax-exempt under 501c3. That's historical rule. Mm-hmm. Effective February 1st, the new last sentence reads as follows, or the last two sentences. Generally, generally, the type or nature of employment with the organization does not matter. However, if you work for a nonprofit organization, your employment will not qualify for this loan reduction if your job duties are related to religious instruction, worship services, or any form of proselytizing. That's dramatic.
It is dramatic.
And that, to me, is the same issue Dave was mentioning before and touched on. This is the administration's lawyer. These are the administration's people. And you're seeing an encroaching view by the government into religion. And it's incremental. But it's constant. Push here, get rejected in Hosanna Tabor. Push here, the Catholics aren't happy, but maybe it's going to work. Push here, maybe nobody notices this new thing.
Exactly.
Push, push, push. And it's going to continue to be a push. It's going to continue.
It's frightening. Before we started the recording, I mentioned this is the private sector. This is business donations, so it's not a constitutional issue. I guess we could maybe bring up the issue of discrimination, but once we became a 501c3 organization, Reform Forum, that is, I was looking for various software discounts, which are readily available to charities.
Sure.
And many companies like Adobe, I was looking for some discounts on some of their audio and video editing suites. Microsoft and others have donation programs for various products and services. And they're accessible to all 501c3s now except religious organizations.
Correct.
Some, if your organization is devoted to teaching one particular view, or if it's a proselytizing, or certainly things that Reform Forum does, we don't qualify.
You don't qualify.
Now it's they don't have to donate to everybody. Now I'm not suggesting that at all, but I'm saying it's yet another picture of what's going on in our society, in our culture, in terms of the views of religion. Flatten it. The executive branch wants to flatten it and make laws apply to everybody regardless, even if it infringes upon their religious liberties. And then businesses are basically not wanting to even touch a religion or a religious organization because it might cause some kickback. Yeah. Think of the Susan G. Komen Foundation and Planned Parenthood, which neither of those are religious organizations, but yet the demonstration of what can happen if you touch on a nerve, the kickback, the blowback is just outrageous.
And the administration certainly influences these things. But my belief is that no matter what the administration is, the progression of the regulatory state is going to continue unabated. I mean, there hasn't been a president ever that's made government smaller.
There's a lot of nominees that talk about it.
And but Reagan got credit for it, but basically he slowed the growth.
Yeah.
And that's all you can do. And the regulators have – I'm starting to sound – my kids, if they ever see this, they're going to think I'm a whack job. But I don't think I'm crazy in this. The regulators have essentially in many places taken the role of a lazy Congress. For example, in Obamacare – The secretary shall promulgate. The secretary shall do this. The secretary shall do that. Well, I mean, these are laws that affect all of us that the secretary and her regulators are now doing. This should never have come to this, that that the secretary can decide who's religious and who isn't religious. That shouldn't be the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Should not be making that decision.
No, and we get these czars now in government. We have executive orders that many of them slip by. And it's a frustrating thing. It's something to think about this election year when we think about just basic philosophy of government.
So my point is I think this government this particular administration has accelerated the process. But I don't think that they are the only ones.
Sure.
I think if McCain had been elected president, whether the solicitor would have taken this position on the Hosanna Tabor case, I doubt it. I'm confident wouldn't have. And Obamacare wouldn't have been passed. But certainly the secular state, through the regulators, have been and will continue to be encroaching upon religious liberty. And I think it's a very important subject for all Christians to think about going forward.
Now, specifically speaking, as we wrap up this Hosanna Tabor case, we've also probably in a future discussion need to talk about the religious symbols and imagery in public square, the Ten Commandments, that sort of thing. We could even talk about prayer in school, that sort of thing down the road. But Hosanna Tabor specifically, and this 9-0 unanimous decision, what does this mean for the future of these types of cases? If we're going to be seeing more of them, or if it's going to be an increased issue, what does this particular judgment mean for the future?
Well, I think David said it well in the opening paragraph or so of his Wall Street Journal argument. The paradox of the government essentially being slug back, if you will, on the Hosanna Tabor case, 9-0, including the Solicitor General sitting on the Supreme Court, the former Solicitor General. Mm-hmm. In my view, totally misreading the court on that issue, and yet very shortly later coming out with these HHS regs. I mean, they almost happened at the same time. One would think that the government would have said, maybe we ought to back off a little on that one. Apparently not.
Well, and the Supreme Court sent a message.
Yeah, the Supreme Court sent a message, and everybody's reading it as a message. It's not like this is a big case. It's a huge case. It's probably the most important case in religious liberty in 30 years, maybe 40 years. So it's a big case. It didn't go under the radar, but notwithstanding that, the government or the administration still said, we think it's okay to ask Catholics to do this or to tell Catholics they have to do this or suffer the penalty. You know, it's Catholics could, of course, decide not to provide health care. Mm-hmm. But the penalty is $2,000 per employee per year. Mm-hmm. So, for example, at Notre Dame, which is not, you know, always in sync with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops in all points, they invited Obama to speak. And, you know, this is a pretty relaxed place in some ways. 5,000 employees. 2,000 if they decide not to do it, 2,000 per, that's $10 million bucks a year penalty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean for your religious liberty.
For your religious liberty, that's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
So these are issues.
That's a football coach.
Yeah, that's a football coach. Well, just don't play football for you. But I agree. This is an important election coming up. My point was though that, even though maybe some of the more aggressive inroads will not be tried, like perhaps the argument in Hosanna Tabor, that doesn't mean that the state, just in its own sheer force of regulation, isn't going to continue to make inroads, because it is.
Yeah, in a variety of ways, not just judicial, but
because the secular state's interest is to advance itself. And there are very few religious roadblocks in the way. The Catholic Church, God bless them. I mean, where are we in all of this? It's the Catholics that are out there in front on this issue. I love the fact that the Catholics are out front.
Well, there are definitely political reasons and organizational opportunities that they have afforded to them that the OPC, for instance, have a lot of resources.
Yeah,
we don't have law schools.
Yeah, and a lot of the chatter you hear out there is, well, look, they put up with homosexual priests, and they climb, you know, pedophile priests, and they overlooked all of this. It can't be that important to them. Well, I mean, that's really not a defense for a matter of conscience like this. This is really a matter of conscience to them, and I'd add here in closing that they call this contraception, but there's abortifacients and sterilization come under the rubric, in the secretary's rubric of contraception. And the morning after pill, as I understand it, I'm certainly no expert, is after contraception has taken place and it's abortifacient to allow it not to implant in the uterine wall. I believe that's it. So it's not really contraception.
Right.
It's beyond contraception.
Yeah. Regardless, the main issues here are definitely about religious liberty, whether we're speaking of Catholic liberty or Mormon liberty or Reformed Christian liberty, whatever. We need to protect that and understand, I think, at root, I think what we can find in Genesis 4, I follow Klein on this point, that the government, the state, is established to promote justice and to restrain evil. And, you know, basically those are the two main things it needs to do. And it doesn't want to do that because it wants to continue to grow and have power and influence. And if religion is untouchable, then that's limiting the power that the government could have.
It's absolutely limiting, yeah.
Well, Jim, it's been fantastic to have you. I do want to remind people of our previous discussion with Jim and David on several issues. You can find that in the show notes. David, professor of law at University of Penn, of course, he had to hard out, so we aren't able to close with him, but we'll definitely invite him back, and you as well, and we can discuss these issues further and any new issues that come up, because there are going to be more.
My guess is that we'll see some new issues in the next couple of months.
Yeah. Well, we'll certainly address that. And, of course, I'll put links in the show notes to this information, David's op-ed at the Wall Street Journal, as well as the information at OEA, which has the audio file for the Supreme Court's decision, and a really fantastic transcript. So you even get to know who's talking at what time. It's a really fantastic setup. So that'll all be available online. Visit us online there at reformedforum.org, and there you'll find information about all of our programs, not just Christ the Center, but everything that we're doing, as well as calendars and updates about news and events coming up in the Reformed world. If you'd like to get a hold of us, please email us at mail@reformedforum.org or Twitter. You can tweet us at Reformed Forum. I want to thank everybody for listening and hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.